And I see we have some folks coming in, so we'll just kind of let people get settled in. You may come up.
Your Honor, before we go on the record, unless we have two counsel for the appellee.
We'll deal with it when we get there. This is In Re Interest of Naomi C. and In Re Interest of Valencia J. And before we begin, I would note there are two counsel appearing for appellee. Is there a division of time or a designation of who's going to argue?
Your Honor, I think we each have 5 minutes, please.
Very well.
Thank you.
That division will be fine. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel, my name is Brian Lockwood. I'm a Deputy Public Defender. And we represent the father in this case. Your Honor, this case is essentially a 3A case brought because the children were having a hard time staying in school because they kept getting removed from school because they had an ongoing problem with head lice. Now, we have somehow gotten from a point where we have kids with head lice that seem to be persistent little critters, and we find ourselves now with the children removed from the home and the court terminating all active efforts to reunify. To add further wrinkle to this case, because it was almost not confusing enough, they have these are children that are registered and eligible to be registered with the Lakota Nation, bringing in the IPWA standards. And I think the primary layer of our appeal, we appealed from a decision of the county court sitting as a juvenile court, which changed the permanency objective from reunification to permanent guardianship and terminated the obligation of the state to proceed with any active efforts to reunify the family. I think it's fairly clear at the outset we have to kind of get through the first hoop. Do we have standing to bring an appeal? And as we cited in our brief, the court's been pretty clear. If the juvenile court maintains an obligation of the state through HHS to pursue active efforts at reunification, the party has no standing. In a case such as this, however, by implication, where the court has said there will be no further efforts to reunify, the party does have standing. Secondly, because we're raising an IPWA violation, or at least alleging one, there's a question, can only the tribe bring that or can a parent bring it? I think the Supreme Court's been pretty clear that the parent who is the who is a registered member has the equal fifth to bring that.
Counsel, let's be clear. It seems to me your brief is focusing solely on the May 12 hearing and the May 12 order as to the alleged ICWA violation. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. Well, that's not correct, but it's very close.
Well, you want to explain that then?
Yes, Your Honor. On May the 7th of 2009, the Ogallala Sioux Tribe brought a motion to intervene. The first order that I think is germane is the May 11th order made by the court in camera, which permitted the Ogallala Sioux Tribe to intervene. That will be the first order that we think is important to review. The second one is the May 12th order, which we've probably briefed more extensively, but our brief does contain the May 11th order at page 6 of our brief, where they changed the permanency objective they dispensed with further actions by HHS or by the state for active efforts. The tribe was not involved. The tribe was not notified of the hearing, despite the fact that the day before, within 24 hours of this order, the tribe had been permitted to intervene.
Let me back up and make... We are not, however, dealing with the May 4 order, which came about as a result of the April 29 hearing. You are not focusing on that as an ICWA violation.
No, no, Your Honor. We okay.
Well, let's fast forward then to May 12, and bearing in mind the May 11 order that you're talking about has already been entered. ICWA defines foster care placement. Well, first it defines child custody proceeding to include foster care placement and termination of parental rights, and then subdefines foster care placement to mean any action removing an Indian child from its parent or Indian custodian, blah, blah, blah. Does that definition apply to a permanency review hearing?
I would think it does.
And what authority do you have for that proposition?
I would argue, Your Honor, that it's plain from the statute. This record is void of any reference to the registration of the proposed Indian custodian of the one child. Now, obviously, the Fern Wilcox group home doesn't qualify. It's not an affiliate with the tribe. But the other child is with a paternal grandfather. And I think that it would be easy to assume, well, this is a paternal grandfather. Obviously, he's a registered member of the tribe, really. Well, to register with the tribe, I believe, requires 1/16 Native American blood.
Okay. Well, let's back up just a second. The Naomi's placement hasn't changed at any time during the course of these proceedings that we're focusing on, correct?
Correct.
She's been with the paternal grandfather.
Correct.
Valencia, it was April 29 and then journalized on May 4 when the county court places Valencia with the Fern Wilcox home. So the May 12 hearing and order doesn't change the children's placement at all, does it?
No, but it does change the permanency objective. The permanency objective is no longer to reunify with family, according to the county court sittings and juvenile court. And to augment that, they have gone further to say that there will be no further efforts taken toward reunification, which we argue is an essential area for appellate review. Number one, where the tribe is not even given, where a hat is not even tipped to the tribe, they're not mentioned in the May 12 record, despite the fact they were allowed to intervene on the 11th. But moreover, I think it violates the very idea behind ICWA. I think this court was pretty clear in its holding, not to quote the court back to itself.
Never hurts to do so.
but this court's been clear. We'll just discuss it. The purpose of ICWA is to prevent the cultural destruction of the various tribes. And where we're saying that we're no longer going to permit even the active efforts by the state to reunify, we are certainly at least placing the child at risk of losing some of that. The other side is, quite frankly, if we look ahead to 292, every day these children are out of the home without any kind of support from HHS towards reunification. We are that much closer to 17 months. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The minute they say, we are changing the goal and there'll be no further active efforts by the state, we have absolutely created a self-fulfilling prophecy where these parents' rights will be terminated. It would be almost impossible to say, well, there's been no contact, he's done nothing, because he can't afford to, and all financial support has been removed. And it's been 17 months. So in effect, it's a great way at 12 months or 13 months to create the 17-month standard. But we're primarily concerned with it for our appeal, not only to continue the record and not to hear and to not have any risk of hearing a year from now, but counsel. You didn't appeal when they changed permanency, did you? And standing in this very spot saying, well, no. We wanted to bring that, but moreover, the county court, we feel, erred by not determining what the tribe's purpose was. Your Honor, the tribe can intervene and monitor. The tribe can intervene and participate, or they can intervene and seize jurisdiction to the tribal court. They haven't been clear, and the county court did not even ask the tribe what it wanted to do. And our Supreme Court was clear shortly after I wrote this brief. They came down with an opinion where the juvenile court had refused to allow the tribe to intervene because an attorney had not signed on the motion to intervene, and they said no. The right to intervene is federal and state, and it trumps even our rules. So it seems to me that if we're going to allow the tribe to intervene, we at least need to have a clarification, which would warrant remand in and of itself, the level of intervention that the tribe intends.
Isn't that the tribe's duty? Once they've been granted the intervention, doesn't the tribe have to step forward and tell the court what it wants, the level of involvement that it wants in the case?
Well,
why would we impose that burden on the court? The tribe is now in the case.
For the same reason that we impose a burden on the court to determine what is culturally relative in its act and its efforts of reunification, whether that's placement with a Native American family, which
that,
could be
that
placement.
Goes to the burden of proof of reasonable efforts. What has to, the department has to show with respect to the efforts that it's made to keep this Indian child in an Indian family. But you're talking about imposing some duty on the court to affirmatively, drag the tribe along in its intervention to make sure that it does what it wants to do.
Alternatively, Your Honor, the statute says that where the tribe seeks to intervene, the juvenile court may, for good cause shown, refuse the intervention. It didn't in this case.
Right.
So the juvenile court allowed intervention the day before we were to have a major hearing, a change of permanency, without notifying the tribe. It would seem to me that the remedy available by statute now to the juvenile court would simply be to say, you're too late. Or you can intervene later, but not now.
I have one more question before I let you sit down, and that is, it appears to me from the record that the issue of the failure to give notice to the tribe was never raised at the May 12th hearing by anyone, correct?
That is correct.
It seems to me that if it had been raised, and if we impose upon the party who seeks later to raise it, if it had been raised at the time, it would have given the trial court an opportunity to say, whoops, you're right, I've got to reschedule this and give notice. What's the policy reason, if there is any, for allowing a party to remain silent when it could have been fixed and to raise it later on appeal?
Thank you for asking that. I forgot it in my comments. If the court would inspect in the transcript the motion to intervene and the order, notice was served on the state, the guardian ad litem, the former guardian ad litem, not a new guardian ad litem, but Dale Wallia, was served on HHS, was served on the court, and was never served on my office or my client, nor was the order. We found it later in the transcript when we ordered the Bill of Exceptions. On the day of the hearing, we had no reasonable opportunity to raise that issue because no one bothered to tell us. That would be the policy exception, if there is one, where there was insufficient notice as a matter of law to the Indian parent.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
There's not. How much time did we take the appellant over? Do counsel want to split the extra time equally as well?
Sure.
All right. We'll split the total time equally between the appellants. You may.
May it please the court. My name is Andrea Longoria, and I'm a deputy county attorney for Scottsdale County, and I'm representing the state in this case. It looks like the biggest debate that we have is the notice requirement, and I guess the state also put a lot of focus on active efforts. One of the things that the state found, I guess, hard to distinguish was whether or not this was indeed a change in foster placement. This is, and I'm addressing the May 12th hearing. Appellant has argued that an ICWID expert should have been present at the time that we had that hearing to change permanency objective. However, the state, the state feels that an ICWID expert was not necessary. This was not one of the three reasons to have an ICWID expert. Basically, the state feels that active efforts were shown in this case. We do have guidance. We don't have a bright-line rule as to what an active effort qualifies as. However, we do have some case law to provide that. The most recent case is in Ray Interest of Louis S. This was a September 2009 case. It talked about active efforts, including culturally relevant steps. In this case, I think the state is very, at least, unwilling to concede that they did not make active efforts. In this case, this is a case that falls under the Indian Child Welfare Act. However, with active efforts, it's pointed out that this is a
let's stop it down.
I'm very sorry.
Before beginning the time, go ahead.
Now, active efforts is essentially, and this has been stated in case law, leading the horse to the water. Now, the state argues that this did happen in the case before us. HHS provided many services, and essentially leading the horse to the water doesn't mean just setting up the services, but actually facilitating and helping. For example, one case, I believe that was in the interest of Louis, stated that not just helping him get a job, but to show job skill training. In this case, we did provide a family support worker, which did provide for job skill training, parenting classes, supervised visitation, transportation services to get Mr. Cross back and forth to either job interviews or to visitations.
Are you contending that there was an expert that testified at this hearing that qualifies under the...
The state's not contending that there was an expert that qualifies. However, the state is contending that there wasn't a need for an expert witness, as this was not a change of foster placement. Again, at the May 12th hearing, both Valencia and Naomi had been placed at the current placement, and they were not moving. The only change was the permanency objective. And at that time, they weren't moving from one place to the other, and the worker testified that with regard to Naomi Cross, her placement, it was very possible, would remain at her paternal grandfather's home.
So the logic behind this argument is that the ICWID doesn't apply because child custody proceeding only includes foster care proceedings and termination. This isn't a termination, and you claim it's not a foster care proceeding because at May 12, custody was not actually changed. Is that shorthand version of the logic?
I guess so. I'm not saying ICWA doesn't apply to the case at that point. I'm just saying an expert wasn't necessary for that particular hearing.
Okay. Well, in terms of the ICWA notice, yes, the state concedes that notice was required and not given, correct?
Yes. Yes, I believe notice was required to the tribe, at least for that hearing. However, I don't know that the hearing... I guess, yes, the state does concede notice was required.
And as I understood the argument that seeks to avoid what would seem to follow from that concession is that the claim that it's an emergency placement, correct?
Yes.
Now, that seems to me a little bit troublesome in that I just thought I heard you say placement wasn't changed at May 12th. So how do we get an emergency, particularly when that was dealt with on April 29th?
Well, Your Honor, that's what, in the original brief, it was stated that the April 29th placement wasn't proper. And I was addressing the April 29th placement as an emergency placement.
Okay. So you're not contending that the emergency provision or the emergency exception excuses the failure to give the notice on May 12th?
I'm not.
So what does?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
In all honesty, I'm not sure what would excuse the notice requirement.
And if we conclude that both notice was required and it wasn't given, and there's no exception, the proper remedy would be for us to vacate and remand for a hearing?
That would be that we would contend that. However, we still, I guess the state's contention is that we still did make active efforts. I guess even without the notice requirement, at the hearing, the state did prove active efforts with regard to reunification previously. And I don't know if that makes it moot when there wasn't notice.
Is it the point of giving the tribe notice so that they can participate in the hearing to determine whether you've made active efforts and to have a voice in that on that issue?
Yes. Well, the state was aware that this would be the main issue. And I guess I wasn't sure how we could get around that issue.
Hey, I guess the state ultimately has an interest in, I mean, the state's ultimate interest is what's in the best interest of these children.
Yes, that's true. And that was a part of the argument was at the time that we made this change in placement, at the time that the state was looking at a change in permanency objective, the state was looking at the fact that this case had been open for 2 years, that they had made very many efforts to help Mr. Cross reunify with the juveniles.
But to follow up on what Judge Severs was asking, I'm not sure how not complying with the notice requirement and thereby not affording the tribe an opportunity to contribute to the process of determining what's in the best interest of the children, I'm not sure how that is in the best interest of the children. You want to take a crack at that one?
Well, I think you know, if we're going back to what the purpose of the Indian Child Welfare Act, yes, we do. I mean, it is to prevent culturally, or the Indian children from getting away from their cultural practices. However, I don't think that's what happened in this case. And I think that, I mean, the state did make a very good showing of trying to work through those cultural practices and respected that the cultural practices were a big part of these specific juveniles' lives, as well as their father. However,
but of course, we're not going to know what the tribe's response might have been, correct?
Correct. Thank you.
Did the amber light mean that we were using part of the... Okay, looks like you don't have quite as much time left.
4 minutes.
Yes, please. And if you want to revisit any of the topics we've been discussing with your colleague, we'll be glad for your perspective on it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court, my name is Maxie Morgan. I represent the two juveniles in these cases as their guardian ad litem. The trial court's decision here should be affirmed because active efforts were made by the state to provide remedial services and rehabilitative programs to prevent the breakup of the Indian family in accordance with the Nebraska Indian Child Welfare Act. Further, the trial court's decision should be affirmed regarding the placement of Valencia because such a placement was in an emergency situation and was necessary to prevent imminent harm to her.
As to that one, I guess I understand the argument that on April 29th there was an emergency.
Right.
I'm having a little more trouble understanding how it was still an emergency on May 12th.
Well, my argument, Your Honor, is that the issue of whether or not the placement should have been affected was brought up by the appellant's brief, and so I believe that that was in reference to referring to the April hearing, not the May hearing. So that contention is specifically aimed at the April hearing.
So you're not talking about May 12th in
May 12th.
The argument that you were just making about an emergency.
Correct. That's in regard to April. Active efforts is in regard to the May hearing.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. First, the reason that the order should be affirmed is that the active efforts in this case are very similar to those that were provided by the state in the recent case of In re Lewis S. In that case, this court determined that active efforts had been made by the state pursuant to the Nebraska Indian Child Welfare Act. The active efforts in Lewis S. include utility bill assistance for water and gas, family support, pretreatment assessment and follow-up, psychological evaluation, foster care, chemical dependency evaluations, bus tickets, individual therapy, housing assistance, supervised visitation, star court access, and drug testing. Now, the active efforts here in this case include family support, job training, a job search, a housing search, supervised visitation, transportation, overnight accommodations, bi-monthly meetings with the caseworker to determine the appellant's needs, monthly team meetings, drug testing, pretreatment assessment, counseling, health care, speak out advocate, a walkthrough of the appellant's home, and background checks on the individuals with whom he lived. Now, such efforts were active because the caseworker worked with the appellant on each step of the plan rather than requiring that the plan be performed on his own. Now, the appellant here makes no suggestion as to what effort or efforts should have been made but were not made by the state to qualify as active efforts or to meet that requirement.
Do we even get to this active efforts argument if we find that the notice was insufficient and that there's no excuse for not having given the notice?
Well, as the court questioned earlier, I guess at that point, once the tribe was allowed to intervene on May 11th and didn't have notice of the May 12th hearing, whose job was it to make sure that the tribe had notice of the May 12th hearing?
Okay, what's your answer to that?
Well, it was already scheduled, and I would think that the tribe would have to take some initiative to find out when the next court hearing was or to find out where they were intervening in the proceedings.
That seems to me a kind of a doesn't fit very neatly in my understanding of what the meaning of the word notice is. Is the a duty to inquire is notice?
Well, and at the same time, the parties at the time of the May 12th hearing did not even know that the tribe had been allowed to intervene to effectively give notice, if that is so required to the tribe, which I believe it is.
Well, didn't the trial judge certainly know?
And maybe the judge should have been the one to continue the hearing to allow the tribe proper notice.
And so is that an error that ultimately falls on the shoulders of the trial judge?
Perhaps as to changing the permanency objective, but not to the finding that active efforts were made.
I don't understand. If you litigate a fact without the other side being there, you've got a pretty good chance of winning. And you want to leave that fact determined when they didn't show up and didn't have notice of it. I don't follow that.
Well, it's possible to remand on the active efforts part, but I think that we will just go back and have a repeat of the May 12th hearing with the tribe.
Well, but the Indians would then have the right, or whatever the Native Americans would then have the right to dispute it or to add evidence to it or something, which they didn't have this time.
That's correct. It wouldn't be identical to the May 12th hearing. There would be an additional party there.
At least they could change it.
But yeah, and at least they'd have an opportunity to be heard.
You provided a list of the services that were provided. Which, if any of those, would you characterize as culturally relevant?
I was just getting to the part where I was going
okay.
to go over the
I'll
culturally
let you, I'll
relevant
let you
part.
Get there.
Okay. The culturally relevant active efforts that were provided in this case include school meetings, contacting the tribe to locate appropriate placements, relative placements, haircuts of the juveniles only with the appellant's consent, and a Native American mentor for Valencia while she was in Scottsbluff to learn beading and making moccasins. And I believe that in Lewis S., the culturally relevant active effort was that one of the seven children involved participated in a camp for Native American children in Arizona, and that was deemed sufficient as a culturally relevant active effort. So I believe that we've met the culturally relevant active efforts requirement here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your time has expired. And I think we actually we exceeded the time on the appellees. So how much rebuttal time did? Almost a minute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If your honors have no further questions, I would submit on the argument thus far. If there are questions, I'd be delighted to answer them or try.
Appears there are not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The cause is submitted and counsel are excused.
Thank you. The next case on the docket this morning is McLaughlin versus Newland.